This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headley in Maryland. You know, the summer is often a slow time for news headlines, but not this year. You'd be forgiven for struggling to keep track of how quickly things are changing all around us. George Floyd was laid to rest in Houston, but the unrest that rose from his killing has continued for nearly 3 weeks. In response, lawmakers in cities, states, and the federal government are rushing to change policies on policing and police funding. Meanwhile, elections are still moving forward for better and sometimes much worse. The economy is officially receding, and confirmed cases of COVID-19 are on the rise in nearly half of the states. There's so much to talk about, and we have three smart people here to hash through all of it with us. Eva McKend is the congressional correspondent with Spectrum News. Thanks for joining us, Eva.
Thanks for having me.
Naftali Ben-David is the political editor at The Washington Post. Good to have you back again, Naftali.
Glad to be here.
And Laverne McGee is an anchor and talk show host on the Black News Channel. Welcome to 1A, Laverne.
Thank you so much, Celeste.
Let's begin in Houston with George Floyd's death. George Floyd's brother, Philonis Floyd, testified before Congress on Wednesday. He and others were there. They were there to talk about police reform.
Enough is enough. The people marching in the streets are telling you enough is enough. By the leaders that in our country, the world needs the right thing. The people elected you to speak for them, to make positive change. George's name means something. You have the opportunity here today to make your names mean something too. If his death ends up changing the world for the better, and I think it will, then he died as he lived. It is on you to make sure his death is not in vain.
Laverne, what do we know about the impact that testimony and other testimony had on members of Congress? What response have we seen?
Well, what we're hearing from the people that we interview on the Black News Channel is that this testimony was so critical in terms of really being a turning point where there really could be no turning back. This was the point where people really had to step up, because we've heard this type of talk before, but never as powerful as this. And in terms of the impact of forcing some sort of change, this seemed to be the defining moment, according to most of the people that we've talked to.
And Eva, we did see a broad package of police reforms come from congressional Democrats this week. What was the what were some of the largest takeaways from the police reforms they suggest?
Yes, the Justice in Policing Act would create a national database of problem officers so they can't move around from department to department. It would improve training and de-escalate use of force. They're also calling for reforming qualified immunity, which would make it easier to sue officers and ban chokeholds. So a number of reforms that they are pursuing there. We could get a floor vote as soon as June 22nd. The question is, will Senate Republicans be on board for this? Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Kentucky senior senator, has not committed to any specific reforms. He's only said that Senate Republicans were going to defer to one of their own, referring to Senator Tim Scott of South Carolina, the lone Black United States senator.
So let's take a listen to Democratic Senator Kamala Harris speaking about the Democrats' proposal this week.
We have confused having safe communities with hiring more cops on the street, as though that is the way to achieve safe communities, when in fact, the real way to achieve safe and healthy communities is to invest in those communities.
So, Naftali, setting aside whatever proposal the Republicans may come up with, what are the chances that the Democrats' legislation will get through the Senate?
Well, I doubt that the Democrats' legislation is going to get through the Senate unchanged. I think that Tim Scott, who's heading the effort for the Republicans, he's a very interesting figure. It's not just that he's the lone Republican African-American in the Senate, but he's also spoken out repeatedly about his own personal experiences with profiling and what it feels like to be stopped just because you're a Black guy driving a new car in the wrong neighborhood. And my guess is that he's going to come up with a series of reforms that are not inconsequential. They won't go as far as the Democrats Democratic effort, but they're not going to be negligible either. And at that point, the political imperative will probably be pretty great to pass something. I mean, I just think that these members of Congress do not, in the current landscape, want to go back to their constituents and say, you know, sorry, we couldn't get it done. I mean, a lot of times in Washington, partisan gridlock is enough to stop all kinds of things. We know, for example, that it's stopped gun control measures, even after mass killings. But my sense is that the current political landscape is going to make it so that does not happen. So I actually think it's probably likely that something, I'm not quite sure what, but that something will pass Congress before it's all over.
So, Laverne, let's talk about the Republican package that Naftali just said might have some real teeth to it, since Tim Scott is putting it together. What kind of indication do we have about what that proposal might look like?
Well, that proposal is drastically different than what we're seeing from the Democrats. The concern there is that, are there enough provisions in there to satisfy the majority of the minority, so to speak? The problem being that with this divide, we're not seeing across the board enough things in there that could satisfy enough people. A couple of the provisions for the database, for police, that sort of thing, those are the type of items that we're seeing on both sides of the aisle. But some saying it's simply not strong enough to handle the serious problems that the African-American community faces.
And Laverne, they are very different places on the issue of qualified immunity, are they not? That seems to be one of the sticking points.
It certainly is. And once again, the problem is, well, one of the problems that we're seeing is that that means different things to so many different people. And one of the issues also that comes up is within the Black and African American community itself, there's questions as to what and how that looks like as well. So there's no one size fits all.
And also, Eva, if you were to join the or observe the protests going on in many cities around the country over the past few weeks, protesters have been calling to defund the police. It doesn't look like proposals from either the Democrats or Republicans include any provision like that. Is that correct?
Well, not in that is a term that means different things to different people. So I guess if you are talking about having different requirements for local or for local police agencies, and if they don't follow them, that they will not get federal funding, that they will compromise their ability to get grant money, I guess you could view that as a form of defunding. But no, they're neither Democrats or Republicans are explicitly pursuing defunding. Other than a few very progressive members using that slogan. I asked Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer about this week. Was he worried that it was going to be toxic for the party to sort of have this defund the police? Is he making it sort of too easy for President Trump and some conservatives who don't want to see any reform to latch on to that? And he told me, as long as Democrats stick with their bill, stick with the policies in the bill, the public will be on their side.
And Naftali, Joe Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, says he will back police reform, not supporting defunding the police. What is Biden's exact position here?
Well, I think Democrats are worried that the defund the police slogan sounds like what you mean is just completely removing all money and disbanding your police force. There's nobody to protect the people. But that's not what most people who use the slogan mean. And what Joe Biden and other Democrats are in favor of is, first of all, not automatically expanding the budgets of police departments, which is something that has really happened over the last few years. In municipal government, it's just one of those causes that's been very difficult to oppose, more money for the cops. But instead, directing some of those funds toward, let's say, social workers, mental health workers, and maybe some of those folks would go out with police on their beats. And the idea being that often the best way to de-escalate a situation isn't to send somebody in with a gun, but rather to send somebody with experience, in conflict resolution, somebody who knows about mental health, and that person might be better equipped rather than putting all those conflicts on the shoulders of the police. And that's the kind of thing that Biden and other Democrats are talking about. And to the extent that they embrace the slogan defund the police, that's what most of them mean.
Although, Naftali, I think it's fair to say that there will eventually become a consensus on defunding. I don't even think even the protesters are united on what that means. Is that fair?
I do think it's fair. I mean, in the city of Minneapolis, for example, a majority of the city council did vote to essentially disband the police department. Now, that's not necessarily going to happen, but certainly it's clear that there's a range of different things that people mean by that. And that maybe is a reason that it's a politically risky slogan, because your opponents can define it just as well as you can.
That's true.
And that makes it something that's dangerous to adopt.
We will take a break here, but as we take a pause, we'll take a moment to remember singer Bonnie Pointer. Bonnie was one of the founding siblings in the Pointer Sisters group. That's the vocal group that built an eclectic career in the 1970s. They mixed funk and retro jazz and a little bit of country, actually. Bonnie Pointer left them to pursue a solo career before the group went on to score pop hits like I'm So Excited in the 1980s. Bonnie died on Monday at her home in Los Angeles. She was 69. Here's her singing Heaven Must Have Sent You. I'm Celeste Headlee. You're listening to 1A.
You may have noticed something at all these protests over police violence. There are a lot more white people there than you'd expect. But how long will that last?
This awakening among white American voters, how far are they really willing to go beyond dethroning Trump?
Adam Serwer on race and lessons from history. Listen and subscribe to It's Been a Minute from NPR.
I'm Celeste Headlee. It's the News Roundup with Eva McKent from Spectrum News, Naftali Ben-David from The Washington Post, and Laverne McGee from the Black News Channel. And Laverne, let's start with elections, because Ed in Fairfax, Virginia, has a lot of questions about what happened in Georgia this week. Five states had elections this week. Georgia's ended up being a mess. And here's what Ed says. To what extent can the blame for the problems last Tuesday be placed with Fulton County election officials? Wasn't the state taken to court over this? Isn't this something that Stacey Abrams is or was working on? Laverne, you want to answer at least one of those questions?
Well, my goodness, I think that is a question that's on everybody's minds across the country, to be honest, because that was an example of what we could possibly see in November. It's an example of what we don't want to see in November. And the blame does not lie, from what our experts tell us, on just one organization. Elections, of course, are complicated. It involves many people at many levels, making sure a lot of cogs in the wheel are working. So to say it's the fault of one person or one elected official is simply to, you just simply can't place the blame squarely on one person or entity. It has to work in cohesion, and that's part of the problem. The disagreement about how things should work, the disagreement about what changes should be made, if changes should be made, on top of the fact that you had the COVID-19 pandemic where you had poll workers who called out, who did not want to come in. So many issues, and unfortunately, there are people in the community, in several communities, who believe that they really don't want to fix it that quickly, because that sort of chaos leads to people not wanting to come out and vote. And in some places, they accuse people of saying they don't want everybody to have their voices heard. So a lot of different nuances here. It's not a simple fix.
Yeah.
But at this point in time, I think seeing what happened in Georgia was a wake-up call to elected officials that they have to make some changes quickly, because they do not want a repeat of this, especially in November.
Yes, and they have very little time in which to make changes if they're going to. Let's move to Texas. Family and friends held a private funeral for George Floyd in his hometown of Houston, Texas, this week, the city's third ward. to be precise. His death, of course, was the spark for a number of protests, massive protests, not only in the United States, but around the world. People there eulogized him. They remembered him as a father and a mentor, an athlete. He was at one point a rapper known as Big Floyd. Here is a little bit of his niece, Brooke Williams, who became emotional while delivering a eulogy.
Why must this system be corrupt and broken? Laws were already put in place for the African-American system to fail. These laws need to be changed. No more hate crimes, please. Someone said, make America great again. But when has America ever been great?
Eva Floyd's niece wasn't the only one to mention specific laws that need to be changed. What are some of the policy changes that we're hearing about from Floyd's family in particular?
I want to say that that was a beautiful celebration of life steeped in the Black tradition. When I was watching it, I couldn't help but thinking about my home church in New York, Abyssinian Baptist Church. It felt like I was there in that moment. Mm. In terms of actual policies that the family is championing, it seems as though the brother is in favor of a lot of the reforms that are being put forward in the Democrat-led Justice in Policing Act. We named them at the top of the hour, creating that national database of problem officers, but also even having something as basic as requiring all local police departments to report if they've had a fatal encounter, if they've killed someone. We rely on data from the Washington Post and mapping police violence, but we don't even have an official record of every time law enforcement in this country uses deadly force. And so that is something that's key and something that I believe that the family wants to see.
Do you feel like you learned more about George Floyd as a person as opposed to...
Absolutely. I feel like in all of what we're learning from the family, well, learning about him as a person. And I mean, his death is really prompting this national reckoning. It's a collective mourning, not only for him, but for so many, not only the deaths by police, but by systemic racism. This is like a national cry out to the world. And certainly we are seeing this exhibited through Floyd's remembering Floyd.
And Rick emails us from Hyattsville, Maryland, and says the only thing that will stop police from killing Black people is if they do some very hard time and not be paid while on restrictions. Why would bad cops stop being bad if nothing happens to them? One of the things that's occurred during the protests over the past few weeks is we have seen crowds tear down Confederate monuments. NASCAR also announced a ban on Confederate flags, which came as a surprise to me. It's also, there have been monuments taken down officially through official channels. Virginia Governor Ralph Northam has ordered the removal of a monument to Confederate General Robert E. Lee. It stands among many other monuments on Monument Avenue. The president, though, so says he will not even consider renaming military bases for Confederate officers. Naftali, maybe you can walk us through what's happening nationally when it comes to a reconsideration of these monuments and plaques and bases and road names?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that that's one of the most remarkable things that's occurred. You know, the whole symbolism of toppling statues is very, very powerful. We saw it after the communist regimes in Eastern Europe. We saw it in Iraq. You know, a regime builds statues to people and values that it thinks should be honored, and pulling those things down is a way to symbolize that a regime has changed. I mean, usually we see it with authoritarian regimes being replaced with democratic ones. But I think in a way, this is a symbol that there's a regime change going on in this country too, not a political regime change necessarily, but maybe a social one, that we're going to look at things a little bit differently from now going forward. And in terms of the military bases, there's about 10 military bases, U.S. military, that are named after Confederate military commanders. That is to say, people who battled to preserve slavery. And I think the push to end that is really gaining momentum. And it's interesting to me that President Trump, he's taking on not just Democrats and Black activists, but some people in his own party by insisting that we're not going to change those names. He sees those bases, Fort Bragg, Fort Benning, and others, as part of the glorious history of America. And I think what the protesters are saying is, you know, who's history? I mean, who gets to write the history? And history is written by certain people, by people who are in dominant positions. And I think that's being challenged right now. And so I think this conflict over, you could sort of minimize it as being just over names and symbols, but I think it can't be underestimated as a sign of what this society considers important and the values that the country holds.
Gwen writes to us on Facebook about the monuments and says, monuments can be moved to museums where the true history can be told, but they don't need to be right in someone's face who's lived under the thumb of oppression, which most of those statues represent. Although I would mention, Gwen, that there's thousands of these statues. I don't think we can get a museum that's going to hold all of them. Eva, let's stay here with this question of the military right now, because it appears there may be some tension between the military's approach, including the Senate Armed Services Committee and their plan on these military bases and what the president has to say. What's happening here?
Yeah, that's right. The Republican-led Senate Armed Services Committee adopted an amendment that would create a commission with at least looking at this issue. So, you know, maybe not all Republican senators or Republican members of Congress are in agreement with this move in a robust way, like Speaker Nancy Pelosi is. You know, she reiterated her call for Congress to enact legislation that would remove all the Confederate statues from the Capitol. But at least Republicans are saying, well, let's at least have the discussion. So that is in opposition with the president, who doesn't want to have this conversation at all. He's seeing this moment as speaking to his largely white base, signaling to them he isn't going to, I think, cave to pressure that he probably views as another battle in the culture war, as another sort of battle in political correctness. It doesn't seem like he's really interested in getting into the history of why these monuments were put up in the first place and sort of looking at it in its fuller context.
So, Laverne, speaking of the culture war, it's worth mentioning that NASCAR has says it will ban Confederate flags at its events. How big of a deal is this?
That's actually huge, because I heard you say that you were shocked to hear that. I think a lot of people were shocked to hear that, and in a good way, because that's sort of one of the symbols of an area of sports, an area of American culture that really African Americans have never had a strong part of. When we saw Bubba Wallace with his car that had Black Lives Matter on it, that was also a defining moment.
Bubba Wallace being the NASCAR driver who's actually African American.
Yes, that's correct. And he took a stand, and people were worried for him in the community that, you know, he would be ostracized. But surprisingly, for a lot of people, NASCAR was very supportive of him and followed through by saying that they supported the idea that they would not have the Confederate flags, that was not part of their value system. And that's a huge step forward, because if you think of that base of people, a lot of those people consider that to be Trump's, those are Trump supporters from statistics. And so that was a big and bold move by NASCAR.
But since Eva talked about the culture wars going on here, we have seen some changes in pop culture and entertainment this week. For example, the Paramount Network announced that it is pulling that long-running reality TV show Cops from its schedule, a show I didn't realize was still on. And the new streaming service, HBO Max, pulled the Civil War drama Gone with the Wind from its platform this week. And I wondered if you'd go into this a little further, Eva, because we may be seeing more changes like this coming in the future.
Yeah, that's right. You know, many argued that Cops was a show that glorified police, that it exploited poor people, dehumanized Black Americans. And in this climate, it just couldn't survive. You know, popular culture imitates life. And now Hollywood has been forced to respond. We're scrutinizing traditions that have long been held up as art and asking, wait a minute, is this racist? And for those who have been asking it for a long time, or been calling it out, like Color of Change, that advocacy group, they're now, you know, getting their day. Cops was used as a recruiting tool by officers. So as we see the shift in the role of how we want policing to look in this country, we're going to see the shift on screen as well.
And Naftali, what is your take on the debate over Gone with the Wind? Gone with the Wind is a movie that is not only, by some measures, the most popular movie of all time, but it is something that the president has specifically referenced and said, we need Gone with the Wind back. I'm paraphrasing. HBO says it will bring the movie back with a discussion of its historical context. How is the discussion going over that film?
Yeah, Gone with the Wind is a slightly different situation than Cops, I think, which is a current reality show that people had been calling for to be canceled for a long time. And one of the signals that this movement is more effective and that maybe there's real change going on is that this isn't the first time people have called for Cops to be removed, but it's the first time that it happened. And I think that's a very interesting fact. Gone with the Wind is a little bit different because it's this sort of historical artifact. And there's a debate about, you know, obviously it presents some extremely questionable values and some really disturbing ways of looking at the world, this sort of acceptance of the Old South and even of slavery. The question is, are we better served by completely eliminating it and pretending like it never happened, or by keeping it, but also having it in some context? And that's what HBO is, I believe, planning to do. They're going to have a distinguished scholar of slavery and African-American history speak about it so that when you watch the show, you would also have some context for it. It reminds me of the discussion earlier about putting statues in museums. In other words, pretending like these things never happened isn't necessarily the best way to make progress, and just eliminating them, but rather putting them in an appropriate context and explaining why they arose and what we can learn from the fact that they did makes a certain amount of sense.
So, Laverne, all of this that we're talking about is putting ever-increasing pressure on Joe Biden to choose a black running mate. And I wonder if you could tell us whose names are arising out of the field as possible VP picks for Joe Biden.
Well, currently right now, the number one pick in terms of African-American women would be Senator Kamala Harris. She comes up as number one simply because in terms of what you would expect from vice presidential experience, she kind of checks all the boxes. Of course, there are other people that don't have the national exposure and are just beginning to get more national exposure, like a Stacey Abrams, like a Val Demings from Orange County, who was a police chief at one time. So she's now a congresswoman. So we're seeing an interesting array of people to be considered for that position. And African Americans in the black community really feel like they were the ones to breathe new life into Joe Biden's campaign. It seems like so long ago that we were wondering whether it was Bernie Sanders and how he was going to impact the race. And the next thing you know, Joe Biden went ahead and pulled in the lead primarily because of the African-American support. So it is important to see this vetting process. We want the best person, not just an African-American or a black person. We want the best person for that position. So in terms of the skill sets as what you would consider somebody who would be ready day one, it would be a person like a Kamala Harris who has that national experience.
And we are actually seeing some mayors' names rise as well, including Muriel Bowser of D.C. and the Atlanta mayor, Keisha Lance Bottoms, as well. We're talking to Laverne McGee of the Black News Channel. Eva McKend is the congressional correspondent with Spectrum News, and Naftali Ben-David at the Washington Post. And you, of course. We got a tweet from Lindsay that says, relying on the federal government to solve these local issues is foolish. The feds don't have the money or power to take over local control of 18,000 police departments. The proposed registry has value, but the other proposals are retreads that have failed before and are not enforceable. I'm Celeste Headlee. We will hear more from our guests and from you, of course, in a moment.
Protests over racial injustice are spreading across the country while a pandemic continues to take its toll. The next weeks and months are leading to a consequential election this November. And every day, the NPR Politics podcast is here to discuss how it could reshape your world.
We're back with the news roundup here on 1A. Joining us is Laverne McGee of the Black News Channel. Naftali Ben-David is at the Washington Post, and Eva McKend is with Spectrum News. So we talked a little bit earlier about national discussions about abolishing or defunding the police. But that was mostly centered in cities anyway, in Minneapolis, a majority of city council members there pledged to dismantle the city's police department following the killing of George Floyd. Councilmember Steve Fletcher represents the city's third ward and spoke to us earlier this week about the position of the city council.
We sort of can't force a culture that really doesn't want to learn. The call to fire aggressive officers is something that we have tried to do. And in fact, arbitrators have sent back officers who our chief, who I think has really made a good faith effort to bring us to a different place, attempted to fire, and arbitrators return them to the force. And you try to imagine, how do you maintain any kind of discipline or establish any kind of culture if you have fired somebody, if you have said, you're someone we can't work with, and then they're sent back and you have to put them back out in the street. How disciplined is that person going to be?
Naftali, what other cities are considering measures like this?
Well, there's quite a few that have talked about maybe not going quite as...
I think we're losing Naftali there. Eva, could you step in here for us? What are we hearing from other cities?
Yeah, I mean, this actually might seem surprising to people, this idea of getting rid of the police department altogether. But this is a concept that has long been talked about in progressive circles. What does our world look like without policing? What does our world look like without prisons? And are these systems that have long been plagued by systemic racism, that have a foundation, right? American policing has a foundation in slave patrols. Can they ever actually be fully reformed, or do we have to throw it all away and start all over? Democrats, I would say a more traditional Democrats, are really rejecting this. Even the mayor of Minneapolis, Jacob Frey, has said that he doesn't think this is a good idea to say we're just going to get rid of it without a plan in place as to how we're actually going to move forward.
This has extended to the corporate community as well. CrossFit CEO Greg Glassman resigned this week. That's because of backlash about comments he made about the killing of George Floyd. Laverne, what happened?
Well, what we're seeing is CEOs like him making statements that they, making personal statements about a company. So the CEO of CrossFit made some very strong comments letting people know that he was not on board and did not feel that it was an issue with what was happening. And right away, there was huge backlash. We're seeing this with several companies who have put themselves out there with a personal set of values from one person in the company that does not reflect the entire company. At the end of the day, the African American community, the Black community, spends billions of dollars in the economy. And so corporations are seeing that this type of rhetoric can affect their bottom dollar, their bottom line. And so when people heard that he was not in supportive of Black Lives Matter, not supportive, not sympathetic, not empathetic to what happened with the George Floyd situation, right away people got on board and he stepped aside.
Yeah, he said, we're not mourning for George Floyd. I don't think we or any of my staff are. Can you tell me why I should mourn for him? He also said he didn't think Floyd's death had anything to do with race. But also among the corporate community, in a very different situation, Reddit named YC CEO Michael Seibel to its board. That's because the co-founder, Alex Ohanian, asked to be replaced, resigned, and then asked to be replaced by a Black candidate. Seibel is Reddit's first Black board member. And I wonder, Eva, if you could reflect on this a little bit and tell me what it means about possible changes among the corporate community.
Yeah, I think it was a really powerful move, right? Because everyone can call for diversity, but there is something symbolic and particularly powerful about a white man in this position of power stepping aside, giving up his seat at the table, truly acknowledging his white privilege, and saying, replace my seat with a Black person. We'll have to see if we see more moves like this. It's one thing to call for diversity. It's a whole nother thing to literally give up your position of power, acknowledge your privilege in that real way.
So let's move on and talk about the pandemic, which is still occurring. Attention shifted away from the pandemic, understandably, but coronavirus is still with us, and in some cases, we see cases going up. It looks really different according to what part of the country you're in, though. After 80 days, all of New York came out of lockdown this week, and they're now moved into a phased reopening. Here's Governor Andrew Cuomo speaking on Monday.
New Yorkers bent the curve by being smart. We're celebrating. We're back. We're reopening. We're excited. Our mojo's back. Our energy's back. Great. Stay smart. Stay smart. Look at facts around us. Other states, the spike is going up.
And that is correct. There are new cases rising in almost half of states. Nationwide, we surpassed 2 million cases this week. Naftali, where are we seeing coronavirus cases increase?
Well, they're increasing in some states that have aggressively reopened. Texas, the Carolinas, Mississippi, Arizona, but not only. There's also places like California and Oregon that have not taken that approach. So it's a range of reasons. It's hard to say exactly why in every case. Obviously, people started returning to various sites on Memorial Day. It's unclear whether the protests have played a role in this, the fact that there's been primary elections in a couple of places. But I think the overall message is that, you know, this is not ending. There's a tendency to be complacent. Dr. Fauci just recently said, look, this isn't really going to end until there is a virus. And I think what he wants to fight
until there is a vaccine, I think you mean.
Until there's a vaccine, I'm sorry. And I think what he wants to fight against is this idea that maybe this will somehow just go away because it's summer and we can declare victory and move on, and to urge everybody to be careful, and that there may even be a further spike in the fall, you know, just when people are going back to school and to college.
That comment that you referred to from Dr. Anthony Fauci was made in a meeting with biotech executives this week. Again, he said COVID-19 will not go away until we have a vaccine. So, Laverne, what progress has been made on a vaccine?
Well, with the vaccine, we're hearing from, of course, the World Health Organization that several countries have banded together to try to work on this vaccine. As we know, the United States is not involved in the WHO anymore. And so they are working on their own with their own pharmaceutical companies and so forth. We haven't heard anything in terms of a concrete date. We are told, of course, that they are still working feverishly on this. But so far, nothing concrete has come out of the actual results of something that could be used in the public anytime soon.
So the Republican National Convention is scheduled for August, still scheduled for August. It is being moved in terms of location, though. It's being moved to Jacksonville, Florida. And one of our listeners commented on this. Chris wrote on Facebook, during a global pandemic, Trump flouts his own CDC's guidelines for proper crowd protocols for his own vanity. He will be directly complicit in extending how long this affects the economy and how many additional people who get sick and those that die. Eva, can you remind us why the Republican National Convention is moving?
Yes, because the governor of North Carolina is wanted some assurances from the RNC that they would try to scale it down. They would require masks, that it couldn't be the large, traditional, big stage arena convention that is sort of the conventional way that these things operate, that there would have to be changes made to respond to COVID, and they could not come to an agreement. So now the RNC says President Trump will accept the nomination in Jacksonville, Florida. It's a key battleground state, his home state now. And we still don't really know the details. One would imagine that there's going to be temperature checks and at least a suggestion of wearing masks. And then I also understand that they might still have some contractual obligations with Charlotte, so they might not be able to get rid of that relationship completely. But ultimately, you know, President Trump has shown time and time again that this is where he feels most confident. This is where he feels most at home, when he is speaking to a large crowd. This is where we see him, truly speak as comfortably as he does. And so he does not want to give this up. And that is why we are seeing this move.
And we're also seeing announcements that there will be new rallies.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Let's move to the economy, because there is economic news this week. And one of the most important, Naftali, is that we are in a recession now. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think that's a big surprise to anybody, given what happened to economic growth in the aftermath of the COVID-19 pandemic. But of course, there's a big battle over perceptions. And there's a weird situation where sometimes the stock market seems to go up despite pretty grisly economic news. And President Trump, of course, is seizing on that because he has seen a successful economy as key to his reelection. And to see the economy go the direction that it's going has been very difficult for him politically. But I think there's just no getting around the fact that there are millions and millions of people that are at risk of losing their jobs or have already lost them. It's a corollary impact of the pandemic in a sense. You know, of course, the most damaging thing is that people have gotten sick and died. Yeah. And then a secondary effect is people who have lost their livelihoods. And I think that's another thing that's not going to get better for a long time. We've talked about waiting for a vaccine till we can really eradicate this thing. And I think the economic impacts are going to be similarly protracted.
Naftali, can you give us an update on where unemployment stands at this point? Because the people are saying that we may be seeing unemployment, I mean, losses of jobs at least slow down.
Yeah, it's one of these battles that's going on about exactly how to count the figures. And it can be fairly complex because you're not counted as unemployed unless you're actively looking for a job. So there are people who have been furloughed, for example, and still hope to get their jobs back when the economy improves, and they may not be counted, but the truth is that they're currently without a job. So it's fairly difficult to put a finger on the exact numbers, and that explains some of the debate. I think what's clear is that there's a lot of people suffering tremendously. President Trump has, you know, he had a press conference where he sort of declared victory and said, we're back. I think that a lot of people probably wouldn't feel that way.
So I just want to take a few minutes here. Because we have just gone through a massive amount of news, which any one of those news items would have raised our eyebrows last year. And Eva, I wonder if you would sort of reflect on what's happening. What stands out to you among all of the things that are going on between the protests, the discussions over police reform, what's happening in the corporate community? What do you see as notable?
Well, something that has been on my mind, you know, we're talking about criminal justice reform again as a result of these demonstrations. In addition, as we're talking about how policing will be remade in this country. And something that has been on my mind is the fervor in which congressional Republicans have talked about the unfairness of how Michael Flynn was treated by the FBI. And many of them were surprised to learn that the FBI doesn't always record its interviews. They say he was railroaded and that he was entrapped. And so I think if congressional Republicans are going to have that conversation, then we should also talk about how the system itself, how it disproportionately impacts people of color going through that same system. Flynn arguably had a lot of privilege, and you know, and we all know, you know, what sort of happened in that case. But what about people interacting with law enforcement with less privilege? Think about this excellent documentary, the Newburgh Sting, about four Muslim men involved in the 2009 Bronx terrorism plot, or this powerful reveal episode about Muhammad Osman Muhammad. He's a Somali-American student serving 30 years in prison, whose attorneys also argued that he was entrapped in a terrorism-related case. So if we're going to have this conversation about criminal justice reform now, let's make sure that we include the voices and the experiences of marginalized groups.
Laverne, in the minute that we have left, could you do the same for me? Could you tell me what stands out for you in terms of all the news headlines going on?
Well, I'll give you a broader perspective. I think the one thing that stands out is COVID-19 really helped expose the system, which led to other things where people were indoors and they wanted to get out and protest. They wanted to get things off their chest. They were upset about the healthcare system. They were upset about police reform. They were upset about the election process. All of these things have sort of culminated into the one dynamic that is changing the culture right now. If you look at Gen Z, the younger generation, they want to know how things work. We're finding now that people just really didn't understand how things worked from the top down to the bottom. And that is being revealed now. It's being exposed.
Well, that is Laverne McGee. Laverne is an anchor and talk show host on the newly launched Black News Channel. Just launched when, Laverne?
It actually launched February 10th of this year. Thank you for acknowledging that, because the Black News Channel was something that people, we were being criticized. Why would you need a Black News Channel? It's a project that had been worked on for over 10 years, and coincidentally launched this year in a time of racial changes and unrest. So it's very critical for us to have a voice for all American.
Yeah, we're losing you just a little bit.
But highlight African Americans and Black voices.
Eva McKend is the congressional correspondent with Spectrum News, and Naftali Ben-David is the political editor at The Washington Post. Just a reminder that we have a text club, and we will only ever send you one text a day, promise. But it is the fastest way to connect with us, and you can get details on how to sign up at the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. 1A's socially distant lead audio engineer and sound designer is Jake Cherry. He gets technical assistance from Ben Privett and Rashad Young. Aileen Humphreys is the producer and editor of 1A On Demand. Gabrielle Healy is our digital editor, and Chris Castano is our digital producer. Stay with us for the international section of our news roundup right after this. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Kay Buxbaum in support of the David Gilkey and Zabiula Tamana Memorial Fund, established to strengthen NPR's commitment to training and protecting journalists in high-risk environments. Support for NPR comes from Newman's Own Foundation, working to nourish the common good by donating all profits from Newman's Own food products to charitable organizations that seek to make the world a better place. More information is available at newmansownfoundation.org.
This is 1A. I'm Celeste Headlee, and it's the international edition of our news roundup. Earlier today, India reported almost 11,000 new COVID cases. That is the nation's biggest single-day increase. Twitter has removed more than 170,000 accounts that it says were tied to an operation to spread pro-China messages, many posting false information about coronavirus. And European health experts say the risk of a second wave of infections requiring countries to reimpose full lockdowns is moderate to high. But the Republic of Ireland has made clear it will not enter full lockdown again, even if there is a second wave of the virus. And as ever, there is a lot to talk about this week. On the line from their homes are Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor of Foreign Affairs, and the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945-1947. Hi, Daniel. Thanks for joining us.
Great to be here.
It's great to have Amna Nawaz back. Amna is national correspondent and substitute anchor for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks for joining us, Amna.
Hi, Celeste. Thanks for having me.
And Seb Walker is bureau chief and correspondent for Vice. Hi, Seb. Thanks for being on 1A.
Hey, Celeste. Good to be with you.
Let's begin in Brazil, as we have so many times when it comes to international news. Brazil still rocked by huge numbers of COVID cases. Its case count is second only to the United States. And Seb, you were just in Brazil. How bad are the things there?
It's pretty bad. I mean, they recently just stopped publishing their numbers because the mortality rates were just so high that the president actually didn't want those numbers to be released. So, I mean, what's really striking about the situation there is how the government's been handling the crisis, the messaging around it. Jair Bolsonaro has been very vocal about, the threat of COVID being not particularly great for Brazil. He's talked about how it's similar to a little flu. He's been pretty active in actually demonstrating against lockdown measures that have been put in place around the country. So it's just quite bizarre when you kind of contrast with what's happening on the ground. We were in the favelas of Rio, which is some of the worst hit places in the country, and the situation there is just, I mean, it's just spreading around those neighborhoods very, very fast. And I mean, Brazil now has more deaths than all Latin American countries combined. It's a really, really serious situation. Even up in the Amazon, we traveled there too to see how bad the situation was up there. And it's starting to even spread into some of those extremely remote communities where indigenous tribes exist with very little immunity to even very common diseases. So I think that's one of the real fears right now.
How safe did you feel? I mean, you're describing going to some of the hardest hit places. Did you feel safe?
I mean, we've been covering, I think this is something that all journalists are facing right now when we're trying to cover the story. I mean, we have our own protocols of how to operate as safely as possible, using PPE, keeping social distance. I mean, it's just covering this has been risky for everybody. And I think it's just a case of trying to do what you can to minimize any exposure. But I mean, when you're going around neighborhoods where people are living in conditions where, you know, housing is on top of each other, there is very little basic services, there's very few hospitals, or really in the favelas, they lack a lot of medical infrastructure. So it's just a really difficult situation there, and reporting on it isn't easy at all.
I imagine. Amna, could this actually cause real trouble for Bolsonaro, for the president? I mean, Seb mentioned how the president really downplayed the risk of COVID, and that is clearly not turning out well for him. What kind of effect could that have on him politically?
Well, I think, you know, Seb's absolutely right. Bolsonaro has been under pressure increasingly over the last couple of years. You have to remember, he was swept into power on the back of promises to really right and steady a flailing economy. And that helped a lot of people overlook a lot of the controversial and offensive and downright racist comments that he'd made in the past, and hailing military dictatorships. And a lot of people just said, we need to fix our economy. This man speaks to us. The governments of the past, the leftist governments of the past, haven't worked for us. He hasn't been able to do that. And, you know, so analysts who look at the region and look at the country specifically will say a lot of his rhetoric, which, by the way, very heavily mimics that of President Trump here in the U.S., playing down science around the virus, you know, urging people not to lock down, going out and shaking hands and holding rallies and keeping the economy open and kind of saying this isn't a big deal. A lot of that was driven by his need to right the economy and strengthen the economy, because that's where a lot of his support came from. It hasn't helped. And as Seb has reported, the numbers have been devastating. So now there's growing mistrust. His numbers have been slipping in the polls. And there's a real question about whether his support is today where it once was.
Let's move to another part of the country. The outgoing president of Burundi, that's Pierre Nkurunziza, died this week. Government officials say it was a heart attack. Some are saying it was actually COVID-19. Daniel, what is happening?
So this is an another kind of politically fraught situation. In some ways, like Brazil, you had the president who was on his way out after having been in power and stayed in power longer than he was supposed to after coming in at the end of a civil war in 2005. And he was trying to install a handpicked successor in the presidency while remaining behind the scenes, controlling the country with a new title, the Supreme Guide of Patriotism. And amid all of this, he was lashing out at the international community in a variety of ways, at human rights groups, and that included the World Health Organization, who he expelled WHO representatives in the country. He was like Bolsonaro in some ways, a real kind of COVID denialist, and claimed that God would protect the country from the virus. And so the fact that, you know, he may have been infected and his wife may have been infected, obviously is a bitter outcome given that record. But as in many places in the world, this is a country that has been in a kind of politically difficult situation with lots of violence and displacement, and layering the virus on top of all those troubles just really threatens to set off conflagrations in new ways, as we've seen in many parts of the world thus far.
Is there a power vacuum? The election was held in May. The new leader isn't due to be sworn in until August.
So there has been an interim president who is installed in the meantime, but you know, when you have a strongman leader like this who's been in power for a period of time, that inevitably invites a degree of jockeying for power and influence once he's out of the scene. So his unexpected departure certainly creates some risk for instability. On the other hand, this was not an especially beloved or benevolent leader. So there is some speculation that there could be a more hopeful outcome here too. But there will certainly be a pretty rocky and scary period. And this is, of course, in a region where you've had a number of countries that have experienced really terrible civil wars over the past several decades. and where there's all kinds of opportunity for neighboring countries and rebel groups and everything else to cause instability and to profit from this moment of opportunity. So it's certainly a fraught moment.
Yeah, and Seb, the World Health Organization says the virus is accelerating across Africa. What is the picture in other African nations or across the continent?
Well, I mean, it's certainly, I mean, it's definitely not going away anytime soon. And I think the real fear is the second wave. I mean, you're even seeing in the US that there are some states now that are having their worst numbers since the crisis began. And I mean, just mentioning the World Trade, the World Health Organization, I mean, there's actually been a similar dynamic happening in Brazil with the president branding the World Health Organization a partisan political organization, and I think that kind of approach is also exacerbating the situation. It's in a lot of these countries it's becoming political, and there are parallels that you can draw from Brazil to the US to the UK that kind of really speak to how the governments are really facing pressure from the way that they're handling this crisis that's also exacerbating the situation on the ground, the numbers just increasing month by month.
And world leaders are taking criticism as well. We saw that happen with someone in Boris Johnson's government in the UK, and then Belgian priest Joachim. Prince Joachim got into trouble this week by not abiding by the rules. Amna, what happened with the prince?
This is a story of a prince who, as you mentioned, Prince Joachim of Belgium. He's the nephew of Belgium's King Philippe, 10th in line to the throne, I believe. He's 28 years old. At the end of May, flew from Brussels to Madrid and then went to Cordoba for a party. The party reportedly had 27 other guests, and Spanish policy at the time was limiting gatherings to 15 people. So he was in violation of that. He was also in violation of not quarantining for 14 days after arriving in Spain. The reason we know about this, we should mention, is because Spanish papers reported it, and then he admitted to it, said it was true, apologized, saying he deeply regrets his actions, that he would accept the consequences. The consequences in this case are actually pretty steep. He's been fined, I think, about 10,500 euros, which is about $12,000 or so. And on top of that, of course, it's since been reported that he has actually tested positive for the coronavirus, now under quarantine in Spain. So, of course, we all hope he recovers well. But this is, you know, one of those questions about people of privilege being able to move in ways that the rest of the populations cannot, and what the fallout from that is.
Let's talk about protests overseas, protests over police brutality, racial injustice, a history of colonization. They seem to be expanding. Protesters in Bristol, England, famously toppled a statue of the 17th century slave trader Edward Colston this week. Bristol Mayor Marvin Rees says he feels no sense of loss.
If politics refuses to understand, and I've heard some messages come out about national government, this is just about mindless vandalism. I mean, you can bury your head in the sand and say that, but you wouldn't get any more than a D on your A-level paper for saying that. There is more. You may not like what happened, and it may be distasteful for you, but you have to understand it. We cannot afford politicians that refuse to understand the populations that they've been tasked with leading. Otherwise, you end up with a Trumpian approach, which is all about dominating and militarizing your streets. You have to engage.
Seb, for many people outside of the UK, this is one of the first times we're hearing about these kinds of civic actions or protests against these statues and this history. Is this something new in the UK?
I mean, the conversation isn't new, but this is certainly a different moment. And it's just interesting to see how much has been just the ripple effect from what's going on in the United States. And I mean, the UK, you see these kinds of statues everywhere in the UK. Our imperialist history means that there are, you know, on pretty much every street corner in London, there's a statue of somebody from, you know, the 18th century who might have questionable history of how they actually made their money. I mean, Marvin Rees there, the mayor of Bristol, he's actually got Jamaican roots, and he was talking about how Edward Colston may have actually owned some of his relatives. Edward Colston shares responsibility for transporting more than 84,000 Africans to the New World, and, you know, 19,000 of them died on the journey. This is somebody who put a lot of the money back into the city of Bristol, and you know his reputation there has been very good over the years. But like, when you really reconcile the reality with what he did, how he made that money, that's something that I think is a troubled past, and there are very dark chapters of British history that I think now are being examined. This is a really interesting moment when it's being really looked at, and not just in Bristol. There's in London now they've actually boarded up a lot of the statues in the centre of the city, like Winston Churchill's statue. There's a big argument over Robert Baden Powell, who was founder of the Scout group in England, but who has a
They became the Boy Scouts, yeah.
Right, and a kind of fondness for Adolf Hitler and some kind of very homophobic traits for his character. I mean, it's a really interesting moment to kind of address a conversation that has been going on in the UK for some time now. There has been talk about removing these statues and replacing them with something that's more reflective of the modern society of the UK. But now it's really unfolding.
There have been far right groups who've pledged to protect those statues and monuments with weapons if necessary. They say that they will be around London this Saturday protecting those statues. What are the concerns about possible violence between protesters and counter-protesters?
I think they're very real concerns, right? Whenever there's people with arms who are pledging to protect something that's come under scrutiny and attack from others in this wave of this new conversation, as Seb was talking about, yeah, there's a real concern for violence, and we've seen that play out in the past. You don't have to go too far back into our future here in the US to think about, you know, the marches that took place in Charlottesville, Virginia, which were led by far-right neo-Nazis who were there because of the country or that city's tie to our Confederate past and because of the statues that sit in monument there. And those clashes did become quite violent. So yes, there's a very real concern for some of that, but also to build on what Seb was talking about, you know, the connective tissue between what's happening in Britain and here in the US is that all of the concerns of today around racism, police brutality disproportionately affecting people of color, which is true in both countries, go back to our histories. And Britain's history is unique, yes, with its imperial past and with, you know, the sort of glorification of the British Empire, which is now being looked at not so much as, you know, a history that's really been mostly written by white men in its glorification, but in a more robust and more full way that I think, as Seb mentioned, is more representative of where the country is today. So the toppling of statues is really more than just who stands in the center of the city and whose names are on the building, right? It's about the beginning of that conversation that millions of people think is very long overdue.
Dan, you write a lot about history, and I wonder, from a historical perspective, do you see this as a global reckoning over these kind of pasts that many times have been sort of glossed over in history books?
Absolutely. It's remarkable just how quickly all of this has happened, and how much it spread to really encompass not just the original issue, the killing of George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter protests that followed, but has really spurred a much broader conversation about the kinds of history that Amna and Seb were talking about, but also abuses that in some ways map onto these kinds of inequality and oppression, but are not exactly symptomatic of the same thing. So you saw in New Zealand, for example, some of the Maori groups talking about inequality, and you've even seen in Africa protests against police violence and issues there, which don't have the same racial overlay, obviously, but still have some of the same issues at play. And it's worth noting, I think, that it comes in the context of a pandemic that, especially in some of the developed countries in the U.S. and Europe, has really put in sharp relief a lot of these inequalities. So, you know, a lot of the underlying conditions and economic and racial inequalities that are being surfaced in the protests were also really clear in the impact of the pandemic, which hit in many places the disadvantaged and the poor much, much harder than anyone else.
Seb, you mentioned that there's debate over all of the many statues of former Prime Minister Winston Churchill. When I mentioned the fact that people wanted some of those statues to come down to my neighbor said, wait, what's wrong with Winston Churchill? Can you explain why people are protesting these statues and monuments to Churchill?
Right. I mean, Churchill obviously has the reputation that he won in, for his leadership of the country during the Second World War. But there were other chapters of his life where he did things that many people are taking another look at for his military service during the Boer War, and some of the views that he held are now out of step with a lot of what modern England is supposed to represent. So I think it really kind of connects to the conversation here very directly. It's people's history being based on kind of a very linear, very narrow kind of perspective, and then trying to step out and wrapping in other chapters of history which people don't know as much about. And I think it's the very same thing that's happening in this country too, when you're looking at the debate over the Confederate statues and renaming US military bases that were named after Confederate generals. This is something that is going to be a moment of reckoning, and it's just amazing to see the lengths to where this conversation is going, and the impact that it's having. It's something that many in the UK are saying is long overdue.
And the Boer War is the South African war that took place just at the turn of the 20th century between Great Britain and the two republics in Africa. And in fact, one of the statues that went down was King Leopold II of Belgium. And Ndiso, I hope I pronounced that right, says Hitler killed 6 million Jews, Leopold killed more than 10 million Congolese people. But that's a lesson that you will never get in school. From the Aborigines of Australia to the Africans to Native Americans, the truth is that the cruel injustices that indigenous peoples around the world have suffered at the hands of white people because of racism will never fully be told. Sharon writes, these statues should be put in a museum called Humanity's Museum of Shame. History's truths can be faced there for us to feel the pain and learn from our conniving, hateful past. There's another story that's connected to the global protest, and that is related to the teleconferencing company Zoom. Zoom got in on some Chinese-level censorship this week. The company disabled accounts of Chinese dissidents in the United States after those dissidents used Zoom to commemorate the Tiananmen Square massacre on June 4th. Daniel, Zoom is an American company. It's headquartered in San Jose, California. Why did they make this decision?
So this is part and parcel of what has been happening with so many tech companies over the last several years. Is they have seen China as a really important market. They have faced the struggle of what you do when China asks you to comply with Chinese laws, which don't have the same standards of free speech and everything else that they, you know, say they want to protect in markets elsewhere. So in this case, you had Zoom calls. We've all been on lots of Zoom calls and conferences over the last few months. In this case, you had calls that included, in some cases, democracy and human rights activists who were based in the United States or in Hong Kong, sometimes speaking with people based in China. This is happening at a time when the anniversary of the Tiananmen Square massacre is being commemorated, when there's a crackdown in Hong Kong going on. So China is very, very sensitive about discussions of these things. And as soon as they saw this started to take place on Zoom, they use the leverage they have over Zoom to ask the company to comply with their own local laws, which resulted in these accounts coming down. Zoom, in many cases, has reinstated them. But it really highlights the dilemma that tech companies face in trying to deal with the Chinese government wanting to get access to the market, but facing these kinds of demands. You know, we've seen it with the NBA. We see it with Hollywood now. So it really is a much bigger dilemma, and Zoom did not, in this case, handle it especially well.
Amna, does China have laws against memorializing Tiananmen Square? Dan just mentioned that those dissidents had flouted the local laws in China. What are those laws?
Well, those laws, of course, allow members of the government to crack down on free speech that they believe threaten their ultimate supremacy. And so, yes, we've seen, this is not the first time we've seen crackdowns on that kind of speech at all. The real tension here, as Dan was mentioning, is, you know, the fact that especially in the tech world, especially in the way we communicate now across borders, especially in the way that companies operate across borders, whose rules get to win. So when, you know, it's important to point out in this case that the multiple people from multiple countries who were participating in this, I think there were four meetings that were going to be hosted as sort of a commemoration of the anniversary, and Zoom was asked to take down, I think, all four of them, ended up terminating three. So they were making some kind of internal determinations as to what they could and could not do. And I think even in their response, they said, you know, we do strive to limit our actions to only those necessary to comply with local laws. It's clear they're very much figuring this out. This is definitely not decided on terms of how carefully they can do this and still balance the very real First Amendment free speech rights that exist and that rule here in the United States where they are headquartered. So this is by no means the last time we're going to be seeing something like this happen.
No, but Seb, as we're hearing from both Amna and Daniel, there it seems to be kind of a pendulum as tech companies go back and forth between complying with what might be considered ethical in their home country and complying with what a nation like China demands of them. Which way is the pendulum swinging right now?
I think, as Amna says, I mean, they're trying to kind of figure that out and try to make everybody happy with the way that they tailor these products. I mean, it was interesting that Zoom put out a statement this week saying kind of two very conflicting things. It started off, you know, paying lip service to this message that the governments who build barriers should be recognizing human rights, just trying to kind of make sure they're on message with that. But then following up in the same statement saying that they are developing technology that will allow Zoom to block users based on geography. So kind of developing tools that actually help countries like China crack down on those types of things, as well as trying to kind of also claim that they are, you know, a service for increasing communication and understanding. I think this story is fascinating in that it really kind of encapsulates this, like it's the work from the coronavirus work from home kind of phenomenon being taken to kind of online organizing as well. Zoom's
interesting.
Something that everyone is using, and now this is a kind of new aspect of stay at home.
Dan, we have just a minute, and I wanted to check in on this fascinating story out of Sweden. After three decades, Swedish prosecutors say they know who murdered former Prime Minister Olof Palme. Palme was shot in the back on a Stockholm street in 1986. Prosecutors say there's reasonable evidence the likely assassin was a graphic designer named Stig Engström, who killed himself 20 years ago. So what happens now?
So this has been a case that has riveted Sweden and a lot of the world for 35 years, and it's been this massive ongoing investigation with thousands of interviews and wrongful convictions and kind of speculation about global conspiracies and more than 100 confessions from people who were not, in fact, the killer. In this case, the person who Swedish authorities have decided was the killer committed suicide almost 20 years ago. So
yeah,
this kind of wraps up the case, but because there was so much speculation, Palme was this very kind of charismatic global figure who made a lot of enemies, especially in kind of right wing movements and governments around the globe. It doesn't quite have the kind of conclusion that most Swedes wanted. There's, you know, in some ways like the JFK killing here, there's a lot of kind of theorizing about different conspiracies, and this seems to kind of settle on a lone killer, which is not a really satisfying conclusion given just how elaborate and ongoing this investigation has been.
Well, it has been 2 years since Kim Jong-un of North Korea and President Donald Trump first met. But now North Korea says it is giving up on the personal relationship between its leader and the American president. Al Jazeera says its state news agency has issued a statement saying U.S. policy toward the Hermit Kingdom remains, quote, a long-term threat to the North Korean state and its people. Adding North Korea will develop more reliable military forces to counter that threat. Dan, walk us through this to help us understand exactly what North Korea is saying here.
Well, it's worth stepping back and just thinking about the drama of the last few years when it comes to the United States and North Korea. There were early in Trump's term a number of ballistic missile tests in North Korea. So these are missiles that could potentially hit the United States and certainly hit
U.S. allies and bases that are in East Asia. Then you had Trump's threats of fire and fury and this kind of round of insults going back and forth. And then all of a sudden, a couple of years ago, this very high profile, dramatic set of summits between Trump and Kim Jong-un. You had these kind of declarations of friendship and peace. Trump stepped into North Korea at one point. And what was kind of underlying that was never any real agreement about what the solution would be. So you had the United States saying, we expect North Korea to give up its nuclear weapons before we start to give them relief from the sanctions that have been put on their economy and are really strangling the North Korean economy. And North Korea saying, we expect to see changes on the U.S. side in sanctions and military operations with South Korea before we do anything with our nuclear weapons. So you had these very high-level declarations of friendship without any real agreement on the underlying issues. And so in some ways, this kind of break has been inevitable because there was never any real resolution. And so after 2 years after that very high-profile first summit in Singapore, you finally have the North Koreans coming out and saying, we're done with trying diplomacy. We're going to continue expanding our nuclear weapons. They never actually gave up any nuclear weapons. So they didn't lose much in that regard over the past couple of years. But they're now giving up with the kind of peaceful rhetoric. They broke off relations with South Korea, and they're going back to the usual threats. And what this is all going to amount to is that, you know, after 4 years of a very kind of dramatic back and forth between the U.S. and North Korea, we're going to be back about to where we were when the Trump administration started. And it's worth noting that, you know, Obama in his Oval Office conversation with Trump said that North Korea was likely to be the most dangerous thing that he was going to encounter in his presidency. And you can almost imagine, you know, Trump, if he loses, making kind of similarly sober warning to Joe Biden without that much having changed in 4 years, despite all this drama.
The relationship with the Trump administration has been at some times odd. I mean, I'll remind everybody that Kim Jong-un at one point demanded access to more famous basketball players from the U.S., and that would be part of a nuclear deal with the nation. Was there a chance at some kind of deeper deal with the U.S. that is now being scuttled?
You know, the odd, by the way, is, I think, an understatement. The consensus among people who've tracked North Korea for decades and the relationship with the U.S. was, it was sort of split and interesting to me, as I've reported over this over the last few years, which was to say, look, the success of that relationship was that they'd been contained to some degree, right? Whatever small ups and downs, peaks and valleys there'd been in the relationship, they'd largely been contained. The real question mark came when this president, President Trump, took that relationship from kind of country to country, group of policymakers and negotiators to group of policymakers and negotiators and principals to a one-on-one relationship. That added a whole degree of uncertainty that a lot of people who work in this realm of foreign policy weren't used to and made a lot of them worried. So there were people who were willing to say, well, let's see what happens. You know, will this correspondence and letter writing lead to something? Will the U.S. stepping onto North Korean soil lead to something? I think we've now gotten to a point, as Dan has said, where we can say no. It didn't lead to anything. The change in that dynamic didn't actually yield the U.S. any tangible results from North Korea as a result of all those meetings. And we are right back to where we started.
So, Seb, this is an election year. We've mentioned that a few times. What might this mean for the president in campaigning? Let's assume that Kim does walk away at this point and that this is not a ploy to try to get a closer relationship going forward. Could this be positive for the president in terms of political campaigning?
I think it's a hard one to explain, really. I mean, there hasn't been any response so far from the White House on this significant statement from North Korea's foreign minister. I think it is hard to kind of demonstrate that this has been a fruitful strategy. The foreign minister was saying, nothing is more hypocritical than an empty promise. That's what his assessment of the talks has been up to now. And I think actually the fact that it's an election year makes it, I think this, it's an opportunity that North Korea has now to kind of leverage as much as possible the remaining time that this administration has before the election comes around to try to get what it can out of the the negotiations. But I mean, I can't really see how that's going to be used positively on the campaign trail, because it's just really hasn't added up to much at all. The State Department is saying that it's, you know, still open to a flexible approach to reach a balanced agreement. But it's really kind of miles apart from, yeah, it's miles apart from kind of what we heard in the run-up to the summit. And,
there's sound going on behind you. Landscapers, maybe, Seb?
I think so. Sorry, this work from home means yes. You can come into my living room and hear all the work.
It is the reality at this point. but Dan, do we have better intel about North Korea? In other words, we're sitting here trying to make sense of a statement that the North Koreans put out that is a little bit surprising at this particular moment in time. And I wonder if we have better intel that explains it and puts it in context.
So, I mean, this has been one of the, you know, the kind of white whale for American intelligence over the last many years, just given how close the society in North Korea is. And, you know, how it has much less kind of electronic communication. It has less of the kind of opportunities for surveillance that American intelligence analysts rely on. So that means that there's always it's a much tougher task to interpret these messages coming out of a place like North Korea than out of some of the more, traditional adversaries, the United States, or the more normal adversaries, the United States. And so that means, you know, you're reading these, you presumably have intelligence analysts sitting in Washington and in Seoul reading these kind of florid statements where they're talking about, you know, the fading of the dream into a dark nightmare, and trying to figure out exactly what it means and what the North Koreans may be getting at. And you know, you made the point that this comes during the election year. Trump has made this at different points a selling point, right? A kind of triumph of diplomacy and an example of how his willingness to disrupt traditional practices and to go from, you know, as Amna pointed out, the usual kind of big diplomatic process to this leader-to-leader approach could yield something different. And so the North Koreans presumably realize the politics of the United States and are trying to put some pressure on Trump to give them some sanctions relief, some economic relief, which is what they really want, because they realize this could be a vulnerability for him going into November.
Although, just a note, the American college student Otto Warmbier just died just a few years ago, basically at the hands of North Korea authorities, although he died shortly after being released. And this may be a moment for the Trump administration to remind the American public of exactly what we're dealing with when it comes to North Korea. So it's difficult. What might we hear from the Trump administration in response to this North Korean statement?
Yeah, and I think to Dan's point, we really don't know. I mean, the statement that we've gotten from the U.S. government so far is what we've always heard, which is that we remain open to communication, we can be flexible, that seems like there's a bit of an open door there. The real question mark here is President Trump, and I think we're all monitoring his Twitter feed closely, because that has primarily been, when it comes to North Korea, where we've seen some of the earliest indications about how this administration is going to approach the relationship come from, which is, of course, for foreign policy experts, not the way you want to guide policy and foreign policy and build those relationships. But time is of the essence now, as we've all said. The election is just a few months away. There's a lot of different pressures on this president and administration. It's really hard to see where and how much of a priority North Korea will be for him at this point.
I wonder what you think, Amna, after all the years that you've had of covering foreign policy and international politics. What do you make of the idea that we're staring at the president's Twitter feed?
I can tell you it's not something we thought we would be saying 3.5 years ago. And it's, you know, frankly, it's changed the way that we do our jobs. This president is incredibly successful at managing his message and messaging directly to people, bypassing a lot of the traditional means of communication that have typically come from the president of the United States. And that's changed everything in this country. Yeah. It's changed the way we talk. It's changed the way we report. It's changed what we talk about. It means a lot more, I think, volatility sometimes. You think one story is the biggest story of the day, and within hours, because of another tweet, the other story is the biggest story of the day. And it speaks very much to how this administration functions, which is not unique to its foreign policy. It also guides its domestic policy, which is that sometimes ideas are thrown out by the president and the rest of the system kind of reacts, which is not the way things are traditionally done here. But, you know, he ran on being a disruptor and an outsider, and it's fair to say that he has certainly done that.
So in northeastern Nigeria, Boko Haram remains active. Despite the coronavirus pandemic, gunmen killed at least 81 people on Tuesday. It was an attack in Borno State. And I wonder, Seb, have terror groups, certainly the headlines have not been covering these terror groups as much because of COVID-19, but have terror groups actually slowed their activities during the pandemic?
I mean, I think worldwide there's been disruption of all sorts, and I think that's had some impact, but really in the context of what's happening on that continent, I mean, there is an increase. This is one of the main battlegrounds in the fight against extremism. The attack in northeast Nigeria was, I mean, it's just horrific. It's you know, more than 80 people dead, seven people in the village abducted. It comes on the back of, you know, years of tens of thousands of people being killed in that conflict. But it's also about countries in the Sahel, I mean, in Niger, in neighboring countries there, where they're really facing a huge rise in the amount of ISIS-linked attacks. And I think it makes me think of the new strategy that was announced from the Trump administration back in 2019, where there was a kind of an approach that was going to have a more kind of drawn down strategy on the continent. They're doing less with more. Like the US military has been talking about, after those Green Berets were killed in Niger, there was a lot of focus on just what US troops are doing there and pressure on the administration to scale back some of its activities. And I think now what you're seeing is just there's a huge rise in instability and extremist attacks. It's not just Nigeria, it's a lot of those countries in West Africa as well.
Let's take the last remaining couple minutes here to talk about J.K. Rowling. Clearly, she's made millions with her words, but they've gotten her in trouble this week. Wednesday, the author of Harry Potter published a long blog post laying out her concerns on trans issue. Her argument has outraged a number of her fans, her friends, and the transgender community. Rowling called her blog post TERF Wars. That's T-E-R-F. It stands for Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. Amna, can you explain what happened here?
Yes. So it's important to point out this isn't happening in a vacuum. This is not the first time that Rowling has weighed in on this. So TERFism, as you mentioned, is basically this belief, a political movement, a social movement, depending on who you're talking to, that argues that trans women aren't women, that only biological sex is the factor for determining someone's identity. And it's, you know, argued that it's a transphobic movement, right? If you're arguing that transgender women are really men, that also means that they are exempt from all of the legal and social protections that women get when it comes to employment and discrimination and so on. And there was actually a legal case about this in the UK last year. The woman at the heart of it is a known TERFist, so to speak, and Rowling tweeted in support of her and faced enormous backlash as a result of that, was branded transphobic herself. I think what's troubling to so many people is that in the scrutiny since then, she has really doubled down on it, the latest example being this blog post. And so, you know, in her most recent tweets, it's gone further than just kind of arguing her position. She's mocked and belittled transgender people, been really dismissive of them. And this is a community that we know is disproportionately affected by hate crimes and assault, especially Black transgender women, especially young transgender women. So there's a lot of concern around someone who has as powerful a platform as J.K. Rowling speaking in this way. And you've seen the backlash include even, you know, the people, the stars of the movies who have benefited from her words, all of them distancing themselves from her and saying that they stand in support of trans women. So it's a real question about how people choose to use their platforms, of course, and I think very disappointing. It's seen as a betrayal by her millions of fans.
We only have a little time left here to say a few thank yous. Of course, Daniel Kurtz-Phelan, executive editor of Foreign Affairs, also the author of The China Mission, George Marshall's Unfinished War, 1945 to 1947. Great to have back Amna Nawaz. Amna is a national correspondent and substitute anchor for the PBS NewsHour. And Seb Walker is bureau chief and correspondent for Vice. Thanks to all of you. Remember, if you're out there listening, you can join our text club. We only send one text a day, and it is the fastest way to connect with us. You can get details at the Ask 1A tab at the1a.org. 1A senior producers are Danielle Knight and Paige Osborne. I Zoom with them every Friday from my house. Our sound engineer and designer Jake Cherry is my other Zoom buddy. Matthew Simonson produces our podcasts. They're part of an outstanding team that makes all of this happen. This program comes to you from my house and WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Celeste Headlee. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.